Hello. 1, 2, testing. Sounds good. Good morning. Not many people in the classroom today, so this will be an exclusive lecture. I hope there are more people online. We'll do the recording anyway. Of course, the chat is open. If you want to go under collaborate in Blackboard, and I'll peek over if you have questions. Today is I'm going to deviate a bit from the book. We're trying to cover a topic about stealthy and anonymous analysis, tips and tricks on how to analyze malware without revealing that you're actually doing it, at least not revealing it to those that might care. So I have two lectures. I have one that is more a general presentation about anonymous communication, based on my trial lecture some years ago, which I would like to present and might give you a alright background, I hope, on what anonymous communication is. And then I'll go to a lecture based on chapter 14, because they talk a bit about stealthy analysis. So I'm not going to cover the entire chapter, but I'll try to cover the relevant parts. For this first lecture, I'm going to sit here and lecture, because I need some of my notes in front of me. But we'll see how it goes. Flag me down if you have questions. By the way, at the end of the lecture, I'll also talk a couple of words about the assignment, where now everybody that turned in an assignment has passed the assignment. More comments on that towards the end. So we're going to talk about anonymous communication. Like I say, based on trial lecture I did in 2011 with the title Anonymous Communication Over Partially Trusted Networks. And we'll try to look at the concept of anonymity and why somebody might want this. Then I'll also give an overview over anonymous communication systems, both high latency and low latency. So systems that can and cannot, or have high delays and not. Then I will give an introduction to some traffic analysis or attacks on these anonymous systems, both in trusted and partially trusted networks. And then we'll summarize and we'll see what happens. Hope it's useful. So, why? What is this anonymity? It's a Greek word. It means without name or namelessness. And it can be thought of as keeping secret information that can identify you as an individual. So this lecture is about anonymity in a computer network, such as internet. So then anonymous communication is about hiding who is communicating with whom. Hopefully, none in this class, but at least a lot of other people, they ask the question, but are we not anonymous on the internet anyway? Because surely nobody can see who I am or what I'm doing. But as you know, using email and web browsers leave many traces about what we do, where we go, and what we say. This goes without saying in this class, but unfortunately, this is not a given for most people. Packets of data that we transmit contain information necessary to get the package delivered to the correct destination, and also it contains your return address in order for the recipients to give you a reply. For example, if you want to show a web page. So, you might not have anything to hide, so why should I care? In this class, you care because we're analyzing malware, and we might not want to reveal to the writer that we're onto them. But we get this from a lot of people. I have nothing to hide, so why do I care? But there are several situations in which different groups would want to communicate anonymously. And some examples are law enforcement. They might want to run an anonymous tip line where people shouldn't fear retribution or punishment if they call in or send in a tip. Government intelligence agency may want to monitor extremists without revealing the surveillance. Private citizens may want to avoid advertisers collecting statistics on their habit. Quite relevant today. Media may want to hide and protect their sources. Activists may want censorship resistance for people living under oppressive regimes. And finally, the military may want to mask the sites of operation, hide the location of command and control sites, and so forth. So these groups have different motivation. I'm sure this is not difficult to come up with more examples where anonymous communication is relevant. But the principle, even though they have different motivation, the principle is still trying to hide who is communicating with whom. So we're going to have a closer look at the concept of anonymity. And the most commonly used terminology is provided by Fitzman and Hansen from 2008. And it states that anonymity of a subject means that the subject is not identifiable within a set of subjects called the anonymity set. And notice that to enable the anonymity of a subject, there always has to be an appropriate set of subjects with potentially the same attributes. And anonymity is not something you either have or have not, but it's a probability based on the size of the anonymity set. And this is quite important. You cannot be anonymous by yourself. You are anonymous in a group that has the same features or properties that you have. And a classic example here is that if nobody, we're going to talk about Tor, I'm sure you've heard about it, but if nobody else uses Tor, using Tor does not give you anonymity, it makes you shine like a lighthouse. But the more people that uses Tor, the bigger the anonymity set is, and the easier it is for you to be anonymous within this set. And this is really, really important to understand, that there is no way of getting a perfect anonymity, but you can get a lower probability if the group or the set you're within is large and you blend in well. Okay, we need to cover some terminology. In anonymous communication, we consider anonymity for a set of actors. For us, this can be clients, servers, peers, you name it, that exchange messages via public communication channels. Actors are sometimes referred to as nodes and communication channels as links. And an anonymity set is then the set of all possible actors in the system that could have been the sender or the recipient of the message. In this case, let's see if the... In this case, that will be here, and basically all the nodes in here too. But it's possible to divide the set according to the role the actor play. So the sender anonymity set is the set of actors that could have been the sender of a particular message. So that will be this side. And then the receiver anonymity set is the set of actors that could have been the recipient of a particular message. So that will be the group over here. And then sender anonymity means that the relationship between the received message and the true sender is not revealed. So that means that these recipients here. They receive messages, but they are not able to, if you follow these red arrows, show that it's coming from somewhere, but you don't get back to the true sender. And the other way around, receiver anonymity means that the relationship between the sent message and the true receiver is not revealed. excuse me. Then we have some other terms. Relationship anonymity means that there's an unlinkability between the sender and the receiver. It should not be possible for an adversary to find out who is communicated with whom. And then we have a stronger assumption, what is called unabsorbability, which sent and received messages are undistinguishable from random noise. So the adversary shouldn't even be able to detect that the message was sent at all. And finally, we have something called pseudonymity. That means that the sender and receiving message are linked to an identifier other than the true identity. But this is something else this is not in itself the same as anonymity. And anonymous communication, as we're going to talk about today, is mainly concerned with relationship anonymity. Systems for anonymous communication can be divided into groups. We have high latency and low latency systems. The high latency systems can provide very strong anonymity, but the cost is delays of perhaps several hours or more. And these systems are therefore best suited for systems that can tolerate such delays, let's say emails. High latency systems are therefore also referred to as message-based systems. You know that delays of several hours is not acceptable, probably not even for email these days. But you have systems that require near real-time interaction, such as web browsing. And low latency systems therefore offer better performance for such systems. But this comes at the cost of weaker anonymity. And low latency systems are often also referred to as connection-based systems. So the concept of anonymity, the concept of anonymous communication started with the concept of a mix by Chaum in 1981. And a mix is today the basic building block for almost all modern high latency anonymous communication systems. And it takes a it takes a message as an input, and it forwards them with new attributes in batches after a delay. And the strategy on how to handle batches and forwarding the messages are called flushing algorithms or batching strategies. So, a simple example. We have up here Alice 1 want to send a message to Bob 2. Alice 1 then sends and encrypts the message with random bits and B2's address with the mix's public key. Let me see if I can show this there. So encrypted with a key, a random bit, the message, and the address of the recipient. This is the message that is sent. The mix, when this message is sent into the mix, because this X indicates that it's the key of the mix decrypts, finds B's address, and forwards the message in a batch later, according to the flushing algorithm. If A1, for some reason, doesn't want to reveal the contact to the mix, the message can be then encrypted with B2's public key, as seen in the lower right corner of the slide. So what if A1 wants a reply from B2, but don't want B2 to learn A1's address? The message must then include A's address and keep encrypted with the mix's key. Then B can return a message to the mix with A's address still encrypted with the mix's key. This way B can reply, but only the mix can retrieve A's address. And early remailers, one that is called Helsignius Anon.pnet.fi, was based on this principle of a single mix. Such systems are referred to as zero remailers, type zero remailers. And the problem with this single mix, I'm sure you detect, is mainly a single point of trust and failure. They're easily targeted by using statistics on the input and output of messages. But also, and this is what happened to Helsignius Anon.pnet.fi, is that it can be broken by legal actions. There was a court order, if I remember correctly, that forced them to reveal the identity of the people using the service. And if you cannot sell, if you want an anonymous service and you risk being revealed due to a court order, then you won't use that service. So they had to close down in 1996 due to this. So what do we do to improve this? Well, the obvious improvement of a single mix is to distribute the trust by forwarding the message through a sequence of mixes called a message path. So if we again assume that Alice 1 wants to send a message to Bob 2 through mix 1, 3, and 4, as seen in the picture, then the sender A1 creates a layer of encryptions starting with the last mix, working back to the first mix. The message to B2, random bits in B2's address is encrypted with mix 4's key. So that would be the one in the middle here, encrypted with mix 4's key. Then we take the next layer, we take a random bit again, and the address of mix 4, encrypted with mix's 3 key, then another random bit, new address, and encrypted with mix 1, 1 key, and then we have the message that we send. And as before, the message can and probably should be encrypted with B2's public key as well, as seen in the bottom right corner, preventing the last mix to see the message that was sent. The message then sent to mix 1, decrypted, batched, and later forwarded to mix 3, and each mix removes a layer of encryption, batches the message, and forwards the message later. How to choose the path has been subject to some debate because it affects the how strong the anonymization is. Berthold and others in 2000 argued that the cascade should follow a predefined route and that provides stronger anonymity when a large number of mixes are controlled by the adversary. Then Dingelvine and others in 2004 favor a free route, so a new route is chosen for each connection, and that this is more resilient for node failures. And I guess this is still ongoing research on what's better or not. So some implementations of mixed networks. Cyberpunk remailer, often called the Type 1 remailer, is loosely based on Chomp's mix design. And this was followed by a Type 2 remailer, such as Mixmaster and Bubble, and Type 3 remailer, Mix Minion. Each generation improving weaknesses in the previous system, which for mixed networks often rely around improving the flushing and the batching algorithm. For example, the threshold mixes, after receiving n messages, forward all messages in random order. This is vulnerable to something called N-1 or flooding attack that Sir Juntok published in 2002. in which the message is delayed, the mix is flooded with dummy messages until it flushes, and then the message is released in the mix along with more dummy messages. And when the mix then flushes, it's easy to detect the message coming out. Timed mixes wait the predefined time before flushing, but this is vulnerable to a trickle attack in which all traffic is delayed until the message is flushed. And then you have pool mixes that only flushes a random subset of the collected messages. Pool mixes do not eliminate flooding or trickle attack, but they increase the effort as the attack now becomes probabilistic, since the message may be left in a batch not yet forwarded. And then other algorithms in this arms race include stop-and-go mixes, binomial mixes, and red-green-black mixes. None of the mentioned algorithms can stop the flooding attack completely. The red-green-black algorithm, however, tried to detect when the attack occurs. Normal traffic is labeled black, red traffic is heartbeat traffic, addressed anonymously back to the mix itself. Upon detecting delays in the heartbeat traffic, the mix starts to add green dummy traffic to the black traffic. This makes the flooding attack more difficult. Just to clarify, I don't expect you to understand all the all these attacks and countermeasures and of the anonymous communication, but I still think it's nice for you to have the background so you understand a bit more about pros and cons about using anonymous communication. Let's look at the low latency systems. In real-time applications such as web browsing, the mixed network's time delay due to store and forwarding messages are not tolerable. So low latency anonymity was first introduced for ISDN communication by Fitzman and others in 1991, but the system was not suitable to be used over the internet. Low latency anonymous communication on the internet mainly fall into four categories: proxy, source rewrite, broadcast, and DC network. And source rewrite is by far the most common technology, and so we'll focus mostly on that in the rest of the presentation. Proxy. A low latency proxy is the low latency equivalent of a single mix. A basic proxy just forwards all messages with a new header information, let's say the sender or receiver address, immediately without batching and reordering of packets. This reduces the latency at the cost of lower anonymity. Commercial anonymizing proxy services have been available since 1995, which then started with anonymizer.com. But as with a single mix, a single proxy also represents a single point of trust and failure, and the obvious extension of this idea of network of proxies called source read-write networks. And this uses the same principle as mixed network, but with much lower latency. The user, and then it's called the originator controlled, or the network, then it's called the network control, choose a set of nodes to relay the traffic. And in principle, storing and forwarding messages is still possible, and of course desired, but due to the low latency requirements, often dropped. So you trade off. You should store and randomly forward in order to strengthen the anonymity, but since you want to reduce the delay, you sacrifice that in this process. In 1996, Goldschlag and others proposed onion routing, which is by far the most common principle used today, where a set of servers called onion routers relay traffic for clients such that no single server can betray Alice. The initiator selects an ordered sequence of routers called a circuit path, and that will be. So the circuit path will be this route chosen here between Alice and Bob. Layers of encryption is used to create the circuit paths, similar to mixed networks. However, performing asymmetric cryptography in the client and routers for all messages sent requires a large computational cost and thus added latency, which we don't want in this case. To reduce the latency, onion routing uses asymmetric cryptography for setting up the circuit, but switches to faster symmetric key cryptography for the actual data transfer. And padding is used such that the size of the messages do not shrink as layers of encryptions are peeled off. So each node in the network will see expiration time to prevent replay attack, the address of the next hop, the encrypted payload, and two functions or symmetric key pairs will all be seen. These are used then to send data in both directions along with the virtual circuit after initial setup. Implementations of source rewrite networks include MorphMix by Renhard and Plattner in 2002, which is peer-to-peer based. Circuit construction there use something called witness nodes. Then we have something called Tarson. Makes you wonder how they come up with the names, but that's a different story. Which is similar to onion routing, but for UDP. And it uses something called a gossip protocol to share information about the servers. Crowds by Reiter and Rubin in 1998, where the user is represented by a process called John Doe's. And John Doe's are grouped together in crowds. And upon receiving a message, a John Doe will flip a biased coin, and the outcome will decide if the message is forwarded to another John Doe or the requested web server. Something called Java Anonymous Proxy by Bertel and others in 2000 is a cascade anonymizer in which a local client proxy connects to a predefined mix cascade. And then the mix cascade is connected to a web cache proxy. Of these four implementations, the Java Anonymous Proxy, JAP, is the only surviving technology today. And remember, today, when I said today, that's 2011 when this was written. And was at that time the second in popularity only to Tor. So let's talk about Tor. I'm sure you all heard of that. Tor is described by Dingeldine and others in 2004 as a second-generation onion routing system that addresses limitations in the original design. Today, Tor is by far the largest anonymous communication network ever, with about, 2,500 as of December 2011. I'm sure that number is even larger today. Available nodes. Even though this is a side note, anonymous users are difficult to count. That's the nature of the trade. But Dingeldine estimated several hundred thousand users. I think if you go on the tool page, they probably have updated information there. A circuit in tool consists of three nodes. A guard node or a helper node, that is the entry into the tool network. The middle node is called a relay node. And then finally, you have an exit node that connects the initiator to a requested web service. And I said Tor had some improvements. Two examples are perfect forward secrecy. Tor uses an incremental approach to building the circuit. And session keys are negotiated for each successive hop, so shown by Brown in 2002. These keys are deleted when the circuit is not needed anymore. Later compromisation of a node can therefore not decrypt old traffic. It also means that it's not necessary to store old onions to prevent replay attack. Another improvement was directory servers, the original Onion routing architecture did not describe how Alice learns which servers to use. Tool offers a small set of trusted authoritative directory servers. However, this approach has a scaling problem as the tool network grows. And so I'm sure, I'm not sure how they, if they still do that, or if they come up with something new and new fancy since 2011. Finally, I'm just going to briefly mention the two last low latency categories, broadcast protocols. Will in principle require all senders to broadcast messages to all recipients. A large overhead that makes it impractical. But there is a P5 peer-to-peer personal privacy protocol by Sherwood and others in 2002 that suggests to use a hierarchy of broadcast groups, but it's still way too much overhead. DC networks are based on Dynning Cryptographers Protocol by Chaum in 1988, and they're quite unique and fascinating as they offer information theoretical secure anonymity. It's not based on the assumption that a certain problem is hard to solve, but it requires secret sharing between users that require way too much bandwidth. And so it's infeasible in practice, which sadly is often the case. You find a great solution, and then it turns out to be infeasible. It's the story of our trade. Let's see if some people have showed up online. Nope, nothing yet. I'll go through traffic analysis a little bit and see if I can... I probably need a little bit more than 10 minutes, but we'll see. So, traffic analysis, that is the yardstick for evaluating anonymous systems. In much the same way that cryptanalysis is the yardstick for cryptographic algorithms. And traffic analysis ignores the content of messages and tries to derive as much information as possible from traffic metadata, such as packet lengths and arrival times. And there's numerous attacks described on anonymous networks, including website fingerprinting, timing attacks, disclosure intersection attack, correlation confirmation attacks, predecessor attacks, clogging congestions, decline to extend, and profiling at exit nodes. And this is by far not an exhaustive list, as research on anonymous communication networks and traffic analysis are both a very active research field. It's the same that in other areas. You try to come up with something better to protect yourself, and then somebody comes up with a better way to attack it. This might be relevant in other areas as well, so I'll include this slide. So before we look at the vulnerabilities that are present in anonymous communication networks, how do we define, or what are the attributes defining an adversary? The capability of the adversary can be classified as passive or active. So the passive adversary is able to monitor and record traffic of, let's say, entry and exit nodes in a network. This includes then metadata such as arrival time and packet lengths. But an active adversary, it of course has the same capabilities as the passive, but in addition the ability to manipulate, so modify, drop, and add network traffic. As the adversary, they may control one or more links and nodes in an anonymous network. Next one, visibility, can be global or partial. Global visibility means the adversary can monitor all links and nodes. And partially visibility means the adversary only can see a subset of nodes and links, and this subset may be very small. Mobility. Static means the adversary cannot change the subject he or she observes. Adaptive means that the adversary can select a subset of interest, for example with law enforcement. They may, by court order, get access to different parts of the network. Then it's participation, can be internal or external, where the internal adversary participates in the anonymous network, but the external adversary do not participate and therefore only sees the anonymous network as a black box. So the most common assumption used about the adversary is the powerful passive global adversary. And this adversary represents a worst-case scenario and is therefore used. But Newman and others argue that this is unrealistic in practice for large anonymity networks deployed across the internet. It's unlikely that any one or small collaboration of entities can monitor a widely distributed anonymous anonymity network. Furthermore, it's unrealistic that an adversary powerful enough to monitor the entire network is unable to manipulate the network traffic. So a less powerful adversary, yet more likely to be found in real world, is then the active static adversary with partial view that participates, i.e. internal, in the anonymous network. And later published work, like Attacks Against Tor, frequently use this model. Just quickly, trust. Just want to look at what we mean by trusted network. In a trusted network, you can rely upon all nodes making up the network to be honest, and the adversary is therefore considered external and can only see traffic entering and leaving the anonymous network. The anonymity network is viewed as a black box. And some attacks on in these trusted networks. Disclosure attacks by Kostogin and others in 2002 considers the anonymous network a black box and only observe input and output messages. Since latency has to be bounded, you can't keep the messages forever, sending and receiving messages must be correlated over time. This can be shown. And observation over a long enough period will then eventually reveal the relationship between sender and receiver. There's been attempts to counter this with cover traffic, such as inserting and dropping packages. However, Murdoch's sample traffic analysis from 2007 showed that attacks will still works even if you drop 99% of packages. So it's therefore generally believed that the disclosure attack represents a fundamental limit on the performance in terms of level of anonymity of anonymous systems. And no method that prevents this attack absolutely has been found. I refer back to what I said about the anonymity is not something you either have or have not. It's a probability. So, partially trusted network. In partially trusted networks, we cannot longer fully trust the anonymous communication network, and the adversary may observe internal traffic or even control nodes and links. And this represents the situation where we are faced with the perhaps more realistic active static internal partial adversary mentioned earlier. So partially trusted networks opens up for traffic analysis in which an adversary has access to information and traffic flow inside the anonymous network. Among the most serious traffic analysis attacks are attacks in which the adversary controls the first or the last stage or the last node in the network. So selecting trusted nodes and trusted paths therefore becomes important. I see that it's almost 9 o'clock, but I think we'll finish. There's only 7 slides left, so we'll finish this lecture before we take a break. Correlation attack. A big threat for anonymous systems is if both the entry node and exit node is compromised. The adversary can then see both ends of the communication, and a timing or correlation attack can then be launched to find links between sender and receiver. So, for example, the hostile S1, as seen in the figure here, the first server, can learn that Alice1 sends messages, but not who receives them. But the hostile S4, the exit server, can learn that Bob2 receives messages, but not from whom. So if both S1 and S4 are hostile, the traffic pattern can be correlated. You can look at start, stop, amount of data, burst, pauses, etc. Notice that compromised entry and exit nodes does not necessarily mean that the nodes are controlled or taken over by the adversary. It's enough that the adversary has knowledge about which nodes are used, such that the traffic between A1, S1, and S4, B2 can be monitored. And there is no real countermeasure against this. To make it harder for the adversary, you could use the store and forward approach by batching and flushing algorithms, or you could insert and drop packages. However, both approaches will slow your network down, affecting the usability of your anonymous network. Low latency systems are therefore often faced with a trade-off between usability and level of anonymity. So actually in 2001, Beck and others suggested the usability should be a security objective in any anonymous system. And I think usability should be an objective in any security focus, but that's a different topic. Tool states that its main defense against correlation attack is to have a network that is large enough and diverse enough such that the probability of an adversary taking over both the entry and exit node is sufficiently low. Let's come back to what we started with, that you're anonymous in an anonymous set, and if that set is large enough, then you get a stronger, you're more anonymous. So in light of this, the adversary should strive to gain control over the entry and exit node, and the user of an anonymity network should strive to deny an adversary this opportunity. And thus the arms race begins. Let me, aware of the time here, so I think I'll go a little quicker through these last slides just to show you that there is different attacks here. The adversary can do something to manipulate the path selection. If you're interested, read this or talk to me. There's one slide that talks about the predecessor attack. Let's just quickly go over these. Clogging and congestion attack is mentioned here if you want to learn about that. There's one about routing based on trust, because researcher has started to study the implication of routing based on trust, where some nodes are more trustworthy than others. And before I summarize this, just since I find this topic very interesting, this is the area that I really enjoy, is side channel attacks. So in 1999, there was a groundbreaking article published about differential power analysis, where it was shown that cryptographic algorithms, even though they were mathematically proven to be secure, could easily be broken by vulnerabilities in their physical implementation. It was shown that time consumption and power consumption is correlated to microprocessor activity, and there's been a number of side channel attacks published since using power, electromagnetic emanation, acoustic waves, and heat. And there's an article by Murdoch in 2007 that also exploit vulnerabilities in the physical implementation of a system, namely servers in anonymous communication system. And Murdoch, he argued that he could measure the flow of data through a server or the CPU load remotely by requesting timestamps. And this was possible because the CPU load will influence the temperature and the temperature will influence the clock skew. So finally, clock skew can be remotely detected by requesting timestamps. So this is just a small sample of how in-depth some of these attacks are. So, summarizing before we take a break, this presentation, I tried to give you an introduction to the topic of anonymous communication. I hope it was useful just to get a little bit. A lot of people just think of Tor, and that Tor solves every problem. So I'm hoping this can give you a broader view to see that some of the pros and cons about anonymous communication, and what it is and what it's not. If you're interested in this topic, there's lots of references. And especially the ones that are at the bottom of this this slide, the Free Haven has a lot of information, and also basically go on Tor's homepage and start reading there. You'll get tons of links there as well. All right, I think I'll stop there, and then we'll take a 15-minute break. So we'll start up at 9:20 with the next presentation. Any questions, by the way? The question was that a DC protocol that I mentioned, if it's related to the DC file sharing protocol. And the honest answer is I don't know. But let's see, do I have it up here now? But many times, it could be, but many times DC network is based on an article Dynamic Cryptographers protocol that has certain properties, and here they try to use that to achieve anonymous communication, and it wouldn't surprise me if they use that to achieve other things too. So it could be, but I don't know. Okay, see you at 9:20. Okay, and we're back. The sound is there. Yep. Okay, that was introduction to anonymous communication, and now we'll go to chapter 14 in the book. Like I said, this is chapter 14 and a bit more. I'm not going to cover the entire chapter 14, but there are some parts in there that I cover, and then I've added bit more information that I have from other sources. I call this "Going Incognito." It's about analyzing malware in a stealthy and anonymous way. Chapter 14 covers this partially, but not. Chapter 14 is about something else, so that's why I picked some parts of it. Chapter 14 talks about network countermeasures, so actions taken in response to a threat to detect or prevent malicious activity. And then they go into talking about network countermeasures, which you can then use firewalls and routers, blocking IP addresses, ports. You can use DNS servers to reroute known malicious domains to sinkhole, or proxy servers to detect and prevent access to specific domains. This is not really the topic of this course, but this puts malware analysis in a bigger setting. They continue to talk about content-based countermeasures, where you look, which will allow then deeper inspection of traffic. Deep packet inspection is a term that is used, where you, if you're familiar with the OSI model with the seven layers, then deep packet inspection is the ability to decode all or look at all seven layers of the model. Sometimes they put some of these layers together when they talk about the internet. So you'll see that if you look it up. Metadata is often then limited to the first four layers, where you only see the header information. So the OSI model is, you start at the bottom in layer one, the physical layer. You have some data, and then you put on some header information, and then you feed that as the package or the data package to the level above. Put on more header information. Call that the data package. Deliver that to layer three, and so forth up. And that's when you come to the IP package, where you put on certain layers, and the TCP or UDP or whatever protocol you're using that has its own header information. So when you talk about metadata, you only see the header information and not the content itself. But deep packet inspection looks at everything, which is makes it a little troublesome when you talk about privacy. IDS, this is just mentioned at terms in the book. This is not an IDS course, but you have intrusion detection systems that are either network-based, but you also talk about host-based intrusion detection systems. Then intrusion prevention systems that can not only detect something's going on, but also do something about it. Email or web proxies. A growing challenge now for analysis is encryption. Once you have encryption from end to end, you lose a lot of, or it makes it harder to get either metadata or look at everything except at the end, and that's a real challenge. It just mentioned that modern IDSs and IPSs detect more, much more than only intrusions. So that might be an old term. So, again, I'm not here to teach you about IDSs. I believe you have other courses for that. The book also then says that you should analyze the malware in its natural habitat. That means, well, first of all, again, I've said it, I'm not focused here, but I'll mention it. Because the malware you're handed have a context. And if you look, if you think back on your assignment one, NullCert gave you a context. They said this was received as an email attachment or something like that. It had a background. And when that mail or whatever it is hit your company, there should be logs, alerts, packet captures. There are users that are affected that experience this. This is the context that you should try to collect as much as this as possible. In this course, you are given the binary. But that's not how it happens in the real world. You don't get the binary first and then you start analyzing it. There's a context around, and that's the message here. Look at where it came from. And ideally, you should then look at this before you start both static and dynamic analysis. You can learn a lot from that. And here some of the advantages. You see the true behavior. Because when you later try to run the malware in a lab or in your VM, there might be environmental parameters that the malware is missing that makes it run differently or not run at all. But if you have logs that showed how it behaved in your system, you see a more true behavior. Also, if you have if you're lucky, you see both ends of the communication. Again, you execute the malware, you see that side of the communication, and you have to fake or simulate the other side. Also, this is a passive way of monitoring the traffic. When you look at what happened in the natural habitat, so you don't by looking at the log, you're not giving away that you're onto somebody. And it also helps you triage. It helps you decide, is this a case that I should look at, or is this and if it is, where do I start? Give you an example. When I worked with this in the military, the first thing we do is to see is this a case that only affects an individual user, or is this a case that affects the organization? And very often, if it's cases, even bank trojans, stuff like that, it is, of course, not good for the individuals. It's not interesting, or not interesting, that's wrong. It's not a high enough priority for the organization. The organization would like to go for the ones that affects the organization first. So even though this is not a course in looking at everything around in the context, it is, in a real case, very important that you use this before and ask for this information. If you're, as a malware analyst, is not the one that has this, ask for it. So how did it come in? Do you have any logs that back this up? It can really help. And I also would like, going a little bit back to the assignment, in real life, you don't know if the sample you're analyzing is malicious until you've done at least some of this. Now I give you an assignment, you obviously know it's malicious, so it's a different setting. So try to think that, hey, I don't know if this is malicious right away. Okay. Taking the table from the book, so what indicators of malicious activity do you have? Well, maybe through these logs you have you get the domain with the resolved IP address. Usually not as obvious as this. And then maybe you have another IP address that is in use, and maybe if you have a GET request with, well, has a user agent that I know the book is using in its example. So this will, and for some companies or organizations, this is enough. They look at this information from logs and they say, hey, we just want to block this, and then we're done with it. And they write a signature that can detect this and then say, okay, we're done with this. For non-targeted attacks, that's just after hitting as many as possible, that might be a good approach or good enough approach. But if you're facing a targeted attacker or an APT, which is in for this or is dedicated for the long-term campaign, this is definitely not enough. And then you need to be careful here. You know something about them. That could be an advantage. And then you need to ask the question, do we want them to know that we know? And that brings us to the topic in Chapter 14 that I think is very relevant for stealthy and anonymous analysis, operational security. We briefly talked about this in my introduction in the first lecture I gave. This is a process started in government or military organizations to it's a process of preventing adversaries from obtaining sensitive information. ISO 27001 resembles this. I've written that it's adopted by civilians. It is. And not only, I'm not saying that ISO has adopted this, but if you read ISO 27001, it has a similar way of thinking. And this, just to remind you from the first lecture, this process have five steps. First, you identify your critical information. And what is critical information to you depends on what's the focus of your company. And it might even change from, I'm not going to say day to day, but from month to month, maybe at least year to year. I have done this for the military many, many times. And for us, we can look at one operation, we have one mission, then something is critical. In a different mission, then something else is critical. So this is not something you do once and then forget it. It's an ongoing process to identify what is critical information right now and that we don't want others to get their hand on. And when you've done that, the next step is to analyze the threat. So who has the means and the motivation to get to this critical information? Because okay, you have some critical information that if it could be intellectual property rights. You just came up with a new fancy design for a device that you want to market. If that information is lost, then your competitors can copy your fantastic design, and you lose this opportunity. So then, who? That would be your competitors. Somebody in a completely different business might not be interested, so don't worry about them. But identify who is interested and also have the capability of reaching this. Then it's the looking at vulnerabilities. Because, okay, you have critical information, you have somebody that wants to get it. Are there any ways in, or is this in a secure box that nobody can get into? So this is where penetration testing comes in. If you look at vulnerabilities in your network, but it should also involve vulnerabilities in your organization. does your employers have a proper training, or are they easily manipulated? Is it enough to get a phone call from anyone and they hand out the information? So training is in there. And once you've done that, you will get an overlap where you have identified critical information. There's an attack vector in to reach that, and you have found a threat actor that is capable of exploiting that attack vector to reach that critical information, and it's in their benefit. Then you have a risk assessment, and then this whole process then ends with how can you mitigate that risk, how can you reduce it, what can you do to make this more difficult. Why is this relevant for malware analysis? Well, because when you do this process, you might realize that you don't want to reveal to the malware author that you have identified a malware. That might be part of your the outcome here. That no, we don't want them to know this. Or you don't want to give out details about yourself, either your organization, your skill level, the tools you're using, or maybe on a personal level, your name, age, location, or your family, or who knows. But if you don't do the OPSEC, you don't have an idea about this, and you're sort of just blindly revealing whatever, and you might regret it later. So if the attackers are aware that they are being investigated, several things can happen. You're up against rational people, an intelligent adversary. They might change. They might not care. That's not up here. But they might be non-targeted, interested in non-targeted attacks, where they just, okay, we lost you. There's millions of others. There's an when I visited F-Secure some years ago, they had an interesting theory about the Nigeria's scams. You know, these very obvious emails you get. But hey, I have inherited $100 million, and I chose you, you lucky person. I want to share this with you. And they had an interesting theory that these scams are so obvious, so why don't they put some effort into making them more believable? And they say, well, because they have enough people that bite. They have enough people that actually believe them, and they make enough money. If more people answered, they would have to hire more people, and they don't want that. They make enough money. And so you might have an attacker who's saying, hey, okay, you got us. Don't care. There's enough other people out there. But against the targeted attackers, you don't know what they're doing. They can change tactics. They can go over to in surveillance mode and try to find a new way in, or they could say, hey, our cover is blown. Let's make as much damage here as possible before we leave. Never know. When they disappear, and this happens very quickly, malicious links might not be valid any longer. Often you get an email with a link, and then the actual malware is downloaded from that link. They don't last long. And then you have to start over again, and you sit there sort of blind and say, what are they doing now? Where will they appear next? So lots of reasons why we should not go blindly into this, but think carefully how we appear on the internet. Then I want to say that OPSEC, the need to protect certain information in your company and also the reputation of a company may, and this is my personal opinion, may be one of the two of the many largest obstacles for information sharing. Sharing information about attacks helps fight this, but it is yes, everybody says that, yes, we need to share information, but it is difficult. It has to do with, do we trust the other party? Or should we, from OPSEC consideration, do it? And also, what does it do to our reputation? I'm glad to see that more and more companies find that sharing actually gives more back than we lose. This is might be a short-term thinking, and then in the long term, it will help everybody. Yes, of course. The question was the concerning the Nigeria attack. If police investigates this and if anything's done to reduce it or stop it, I'm sure there is. But that's outside what, yeah, I know about. But I'm hoping the answer is yes. So, but it's. You're pointing to, and that's probably a topic for one of the other classes you might take, but you have victims in Norway that want the help of the Norwegian police, but the criminals are in Nigeria, and then you need, do you have proper cooperation between the police here and there? All sorts of challenges arise, and now we're saying Nigeria, but there might be other places too. That's just for me, that's just the name of the group of attacks, not necessarily the country. So, so I hope so, but I'm, yeah, not the right person to ask. So, how to identify investigative activity? So, this is seen from the the people writing the malicious code. Monitor online services. Mentioned it before, but the serious players, they will notice the minute this is uploaded to VirusTotal and other services. They look very careful for this. If the attack is a spear phishing email with a link, you can look at, does the IP address that attempts to access the link deviate from the victim's IP? Okay, they infected a certain computer, certain place. Is the malware moved to one of your PCs? And okay, the link is clicked through and the new IP address instead of where it was infected. So they will look at this. And also, they log infections. They keep track of where the infections are. They use blog comments, Twitter, etc., to keep track of this. There can be unique code in the links, so that clicking on your link has one unique code. My malware, the one I receive, have a different code. And the link might only work a certain number of times. There could be they can embed a user unused domain in the malware and see how many time monitor how many attempts there are to resolve that domain, because that's a domain that nobody else should go to. It's not natural to go to an unused domain, and I'm sure. You can think of many other methods yourself. That's just a challenge. This is part of the bottom. Can you think of methods? Yeah, that's how you need to think in the OPSEC when you're thinking OPSEC. So let's see a little bit what can we do. So what's safely investigate an attacker online? And I've written safely in quotation marks on purpose. First step, do not use internet. That is the obvious safest option. And what we encourage as far as possible. And that's why you are using a virtual machine where Remnux is simulating the internet for you. We don't want you to go on the internet with right away. But of course, this is impractical. Maybe not for the hard core code analysis that you do in IDA. We get the results we want to a certain extent, but you may want to check, has anyone seen this before? So you take the hash and check on VirusTotal. You take the IP address and check with different tools or the domain. That's difficult to do without the internet, impossible. And also you want to share information. You've done this analysis and you want to share with others. Some of the analysis can be done with offline tools. They're often expensive. But this is, of course, the safest way. So, can we avoid it? Well, when you detect something, a user calls in and say, hey, I opened this attachment, something happened, can you have a look at it? You look at, like we talked about, you look at the context, the logs, the passive things that won't reveal anything. And then you can at least say, is it targeted or is it non-targeted? And if it's targeted, how targeted is it? And this is this you can find out with checking the logs in your own network. You could do make a YAR rule like you tried in the assignment. Somebody told me that's a glorified grep for files. If you're familiar with grep, if you make a YARA rule or at least know what to look for, you can search your own network without going out and see: is it only one computer? Then it's very targeted. Is it all computer? Then it's less targeted. So try to build up an idea about what you're facing. And then you get to a point where you don't get any further without blowing your cover, or at least you need to go on the internet. And this happens. I saw the assignment. Some of you took the hash up the virus total, found out what they already said. And that's fine in this case, but if you had a new piece of malware, you would have told the attacker that you had seen this. All right, this refers a little bit back to the first lecture I gave, and there are two terms of unobservability and anonymity. When you decide to go on the internet, there are two, you may fall in at least two categories. One, we do not want the adversary to know we are onto them at all. This could be the case if it's a new, unique sample, or if it's very targeted. You get it on only the top management's computers or a single person's computer. This is then related to the unobservability. You don't want your internet access to be detected at all. And then you have the other one. It's okay to reveal that someone is onto them, but you don't want them to know it's you. Could be that the sample that you know that the sample is seen before, or it's less targeted. It's the anonymity term that comes in. You do want to do the search, and you don't care if they see, hey, somebody's looking for this, but you just don't want them it to be traced back to you. So, indirect tactics. There's a little bit about this, and this is from the book. You want to evade the attacker's watchful eye. And like we talked about, anonymity can do this. Proxy servers, Tor, web-based anonymizer, to protect your organization's privacy. So this is not the unobservability, this is the anonymity. So use Tor, just be aware that, and you should know it by now, that using Tor still raises suspicion, as Tor is not mainstream yet. There, yes, there are a lot of people that use it, but actually, it is a red flag that goes up if somebody uses Tor still. So this still reveals that someone's onto them. Then you can use, like we do, a dedicated virtual machine. You can hide your location by using cell phone, VPN, or cloud-based services like Amazon EC2. And then search engines usually safe. Let's talk a little bit about that. Yes, if you use Google, if you want to search for some keywords or some text in a spear phishing email, you use Google and they do the search on your behalf. But if you're searching something that is not seen before, like an unknown domain, then you risk that the search will go and more actively access that that page. And there is something that is called prefetching in your browser. So when you get the search results, it might prefetch the results further down, even before you click. This should be turned off in your browser. I don't have the information for you how to do it yet. Maybe some of you are good users and already know this. I have Sergey looking into it. So I'm hoping I can give you a list of how to do it in Chrome, Firefox, Internet Explorer, the more common browsers. If any of you already know how to do this, I appreciate an email or put it out on the malware blog that we have in Blackboard. But the point is, when you search on the internet, even with the browser, you should know what the browser is doing. So if you connect to Google, you want it to connect to Google. You don't want it to prefetch the page directly from some of the search results, and then connecting your computer to that site. And the same thing happens if you click on a result. Then it's not Google that is going there anymore, but you're contacting the site. So even though it is very useful to search for metadata or text in phishing emails or in the malware to see if others have analyzed similar malware or to see if the text has been copied from somewhere. So you won't analyze long until you see that, hey, this will be useful. Just be aware of what you're doing. Make the conscious decision that, yes, we are willing to take the risk. And also be conscious about what do I connect to. Do I connect only to Google, or do I risk connecting to something else? The book continues to talk about getting IP addresses and the domain information. If you think about kill chain, there is a command and control step there. And it is fundamental for much of the malware to use IP addresses and the domain names to communicate. And that has to do with they use what we use to blend in. And it's also flexible and robust. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but this is the figure from the book. You can also look at the how the DNS protocol is built up. If you don't know it already, see what information is found in the headers there. But when you register a domain, certain information is put in, and that is available for people to search with, let's say, who is. And there's also, if the domain or the IP address is blacklisted, it's also found here, and also some geo information. And there are tools that you can use to do this. Domain tools, address is down there, is one that for 15 years has provided the Whois service. Whois looks up this recorded DNS information. It also has historical DNS records. And it will do what they call reverse IP lookups. You have an IP address, and they can list all the domains associated with that. You can also do what they call reverse Whois, where you have some metadata about the contact in the contact information, and they can look up and see what's behind that. If this is useful for you, you need this, then use the link, have a look. There's a lot more services than I listed here. Some payment that's required for the most fancy services, but the Whois part is free. RobTex, another tool, reverse IP lookup. It also checks blacklists. I went in and just had a quick look. There was a lot of advertisement when I went in and used that that tool. Maybe if you pay for it, you avoid it, but I found it a bit annoying. But they have a lot of services that might be helpful if you need it. BFK DNS logger. This is interesting, and this is a passive DNS monitoring tool. It passively monitors the DNS protocol and records the information. And that can be very useful if you want to see if there's been any command and control traffic in the past. Ten, 15 years ago, when I started up in this, this was monitoring the DNS information was quite new. Now it's more common to do it. And if I would say it's worth activating something like that in your network if you don't have it already, it can give you quite an edge. The book covers has quite a lot about content-based network countermeasures. And this is by identifying malware using more fundamental characteristics than IP addresses and domain names. I will go briefly through it because this is a little bit beside the topic, which is stealthy and anonymous analysis. But basically looks at, and it's obvious too that IP addresses and domain names may be short-lived, and you should use more fundamental features. And the example in the book talks about how it's a balance between false positive and false negatives. False positive wastes your time, and false negatives, that's the malware that you don't detect, so that endangers your network. And this is difficult. Nothing new. But there is read the example in the book if you want to learn more about this. They also talk about something that I think is quite obvious, and you already did this in assignment one: combine static and dynamic analysis to find the deeper characteristics. When NOSAT asks you to find the crypto algorithm or the crypto key in the assignment, that's a good YARA rule. That's basically this: you want to find a deeper more deeper technical information. something that some of you fell in this pit in assignment one, danger of overanalysis. That's always a danger. You could, like I mentioned, some companies, they want to stop it. They know the IP address. Let's just stop there. And then you could dig deeper down in the communication method, the operational replication, and eventually you get down to where we are. Well, we're not going to understand every block of code, but you're down there where you actually try to understand the blocks of code so you can detect the crypto key, let's say that, and use that. So that was very briefly. I end this with the attacker's perspective. That's the last bit of the chapter two, because this is I see that I'm going a little bit over, but I'll be done in five plus minutes. This is a constant game of cat and mouse, but just remember that in the same way you have limited resources, so do the attackers. They also struggle with tools, updates, compatibility, that if they have to change the entire code, it's risky, it might not work anymore, and it costs money. If you remember the kill chain, dedicated attackers need to cover all these seven steps to get done what they want to do. So if you put signatures on all the steps or interfere with them in as many steps as you can, you force them to reinvent these steps, and that cost resources. So if you can put a resource cost on them, it makes them more difficult for them. They do the same thing with you. I think we're gonna cover in a later chapter with how they make the malware as complicated as possible to waste your time. They might insert rubbish code in there that is actually doing nothing, and the whole purpose is to waste your time. Well, it's payback time. Do the same back. Book mentions three rules of thumb. Focus on elements in the protocol that are part of both ends. Focus on elements of the protocol known to be part of a key. Identify elements of the protocol that are not immediately apparent in traffic. All of these, for me, ends up in the same thing, namely, inflict the most cost on the attacker by looking at as much as possible in the kill chain. All right, that was, I have one slide left that relates to the lab, but that was the end of the lecture today. Summing up that just quickly, anonymous and stealthy analysis. Don't go on the internet. Well, that's not possible, but be conscious about it. Make sure you just don't jump around on the internet and analyze and reveal what you're doing without thinking. You have to go on the internet, but make sure it's a rational thought behind it, that you have analyzed as much as you can, and you go out there with realizing that what I'm doing now might reveal that we're onto them, and that's okay, or yeah, understand the risk. Questions about that? No. Last thing I want to say is lab today, of course, is there's a lab for chapter 14. Have a look at that. Then also I want to briefly say something about the assignment number one. The results varied a great deal, as it normally does. I'm going to try to be more precise about how I describe the assignment. I know that some of you misunderstood a little bit there, so I need to do that. When it comes to how to write the report, I'll be more specific next time. Some of you did great. Some of you write, and that's perfectly fine. But you write an answer to me as a teacher. What I want you to do is write the report to your company. But we'll talk about that for assignment two. The analysis itself, basic static analysis. So looking for strings, import, export functions, entropy, hashes, to see if you find IOCs that indicate malicious behavior. Most of you are comfortable with this. Now you got a code that you know is malicious, but next time try to pretend you don't know this and do a good job here. Look at the strings and the import-export functions. What functions in here can indicate that it's doing something that it shouldn't? Go back to the first lectures and if you're not sure about that. The basic dynamic. Executing the malicious code, monitoring with tools like RegShot and Process Monitor and others is probably the part that overall was performed best. Almost all of you detected there was a file that was created, and almost all of you detected there was a register that was changed for persistence. Very good. That was done through basic dynamic. Then we come to advanced static with IDA Pro. You need practice. That's the weakest part for in this assignment, and that's very natural because it's also the hardest part. It needs practice. Okay, question was, since we need practice, what is my expectations? Good question, by the way. I don't know if I can precisely... what I at least expect is that you're able to use IDA Pro and at least maneuver through the code and read some of the functions and loops and form your own hypothesis about what's going on. At this time, I this is what I expected on this, that you were able to look at the code in IDA, were able to maneuver around, were able to at least form an hypothesis about one or a couple of the functions. If you're correct or not, it is difficult to understand what to do, but at least that you were able to, hey, this looks like because here's a call that has that function, that might be. That I would have liked to see. And some of you have done it. There could be wrong. Some have done it and done it well. Others didn't try IDA at all. So I guess that's what I can say now, and then I'll see. I don't want to promise things I can't, but I could give you tons of malware to work on. But I don't know if that's helpful unless you get a feedback. And so we need to think about how we do that. But it's one. It's just what I learned from assignment one is that that's